What has created your friends? The Suez Canal crisis, which is agitating the minds of people all over the world. Why is the free world so disturbed about it? Why have international conferences been summoned to consider and to take action? Why is the matter at the moment up before the Security Council of the United Nations in the presence of the prime ministers of all the great powers of the earth? The answer is quite simple. The Egyptian dictator Nasser has unceremoniously seized the Suez Canal, which runs through the territory of Egypt, and has abruptly terminated its international control, which has been in effect for close on to 90 years. The Suez Canal, of course, was not built by Egypt. It was built by the French. When the concession to build the canal was granted to Ferdinand de Lesseps back in 1854 and again in 1856, the concession to build a canal across that isthmus connecting Port Said on the Mediterranean and Suez on the Red Sea in order to enable ocean-going ships to pass through on their way to the Orient from Europe instead of going around the continent of Africa. When that concession was granted to the French diplomat de Lesseps, Egypt was actually part of the Turkish Empire. It was governed from Constantinople, and the concession was received from the hereditary Turkish viceroy in Egypt. The canal was built by a French company, which has administered it ever since its completion in 1869. A few years later, the British bought up a sizable block of stock from the Khedive of Egypt through a very skillful diplomatic maneuver on the part of Benjamin Disraeli, who was at that time Prime Minister of Great Britain, which gave Great Britain virtual control of the company. But its board of directors has constantly been international in character, and today on that board is one American, one Dutchman, five Egyptians, nine British, and 16 Frenchmen. The concession was granted for 99 years and still has 12 years to run. And through the years, the Egyptian government received a share of the revenues of the income of the canal, perhaps not as large as it felt itself entitled to, but no government of Egypt has ever asserted the right of seizure until Colonel Nasser took over the canal without consulting anybody and nationalized it. Great Britain has for years maintained troops in the Canal Zone, especially during World War I. The defense of the canal became so critical and so important to the free world that the Allies handed over the military defense of the canal to Great Britain. And the Canal Zone became a vast military base. From it, you will recall, General Allenby waged this campaign against the Turks in Palestine. It remained an important point for the Allies to defend in the Second World War. But with the close of the Second World War and nationalist agitation in Egypt, demanded the withdrawal of British troops from the Canal Zone. And after considerable conflict and controversy, an agreement was finally reached in 1954, by the terms of which Great Britain withdrew all of its 80,000 troops from the Canal Zone. Now, why was Nasser not willing to wait the 12 years until the canal would automatically become Egyptian property under its sole sovereign control? Here again, the answer is quite simple. Dictators cannot wait. They ride into power on the wave of so many extreme promises which they make to their people that they must deliver before long. They must bring to their people certain triumphs and victories and achievements to justify the seizure of power on their part. The governments which preceded that of Nasser were either corrupt, like the government of King Farouk, or weak, like the government of President Naguib. Nasser promised the Egyptian people vast economic improvements, which the people of Egypt are so desperately in need of, great land reforms, great building and irrigation projects. Now, these laudable programs are very difficult and slow of realization. It takes a lot of time, requires hard work and planning, and must encounter considerable resistance. It is easier by far to beguile the masses with dreams of conquest, with a glow of prestige, and military adventures of one kind or another are really the only way, or perhaps dramatic political triumphs by which the masses can be kept, at least for some time, pacified and content, and their attentions diverted from the real pressing problems, their day-by-day problems of improving their economic lot. Nasser scored heavily when he forced Great Britain to evacuate the Canal Zone. And in this he was greatly helped by the United States government. Our government believed that Nasser represented a progressive force in Egypt. He was a true reformer, they believed. He would be a dependable ally. He was a strong man, And people in our State Department are frequently captivated and have a great weakness for strong men. They build their hopes upon strong men, hopes which have time and again been defeated, frustrated, upon a strong man saving his situation in that troubled part of the world. I say that Nasser scored heavily when he succeeded in having the great empire of Great Britain remove all of its forces from the Canal Zone. But getting the British out was not giving bread to his people. And the glamour of that achievement could not last indefinitely. And his reforms were not succeeding very well. And he needed another dramatic triumph to bolster up his regime and to increase his prestige in the whole Arab world. For Nasser, like all dictators, is not content to limit his activities domestically, as it were, and to confine his reforms and his power within the frontiers of his own country. They all have the bug of expansionism. He has dreams of the hegemony of the Arab world. Hitler dreamt of a pan-Germanism. And Nasser is dreaming of a pan-Arabism. He sees himself as the Führer of a great Arab world from northern Africa to the gates of India. And there is a nationalism very rife in that Arab world today, especially in North Africa, which can easily be capitalized upon. And it has a rallying cry, just as Hitler had the rallying cry of the Juden. So Nasser found the rallying cry in the State of Israel. The State of Israel must be destroyed. Arab ambitions can never be satisfied in the world until the State of Israel is destroyed. Just as Hitler maintained that the German people can never be saved until the Jews are exterminated. To accomplish his purpose of crushing Israel, he needed arms. Now, he could buy some of these arms in the Western world. They were prepared to sell it to him. In the early days, they actually did sell him some arms. But the vast quantity of arms that he required had to be paid for in cash, and he did not have the money. And the West would not sell him these vast quantities of arms unconditionally. They knew that he did not require these arms to defend Egypt. Egypt was not being threatened by anyone. But in the back of his mind, he had the hope of arming himself to attack Israel. They were not prepared to cooperate with him, the Western powers, in this ambition of Nasser. And so they put conditions upon the sale of arms to him, which, of course, he could not accept, would not accept. And so this man, who had no particular scruples about communism, or anything else for that matter, turned to the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union was very glad to accommodate him, to sell him the arms, because that was their long hoped for and looked for opportunity to infiltrate the Mediterranean world, to penetrate the Middle East, to establish themselves economically and then politically in that part of the world. With the sale of arms goes much more than a mere selling of arms. With it goes technicians and engineers and close economic and diplomatic relationships. The Soviet Union saw the opening of a glorious new chapter of Soviet communist penetration in that great part of the world. And they were prepared not to insist so much on the price, nor on cash payment. They were prepared to take a mortgage on the cotton futures of Egypt. And so more than $250 million worth of jet planes and Aleutian bombers and 60-ton tanks and submarines were made available to Egypt, a country which needed them not at all, a country which needed bread and medicine, hospitals and schools. And Nasser mortgaged the future, the economic future of his country, in order to acquire these arms so that he can proceed to carry out his program to attack Israel, and by scoring a victory over Israel to establish himself as the leader, the Führer of the whole Arab world. Well, such vast quantities of arms have to be, so to speak, digested. You have to train pilots, you have to train technicians, mechanics, you have to train an army. It can be done overnight. So while Nasser was digesting these vast armaments which he had acquired, he turned to a second great dream, namely that of building the Aswan High Dam on the Nile in order to irrigate vast new tracts of land, hundreds of thousands of new acres of land for his people. A legitimate ambition, which he might have carried out if it weren't for his prime objective of military prowess and victory. And so rumors were set afloat that the Soviet government is also prepared to finance the building of this dam, prepared to advance some $200 million of the $600 million required. And quickly to counteract this offer, so-called, of the Russians, our own government offered to negotiate with Nasser on the financing of the building of this dam. But Nasser continued his flirtations with the communist world, with Tito, with China, to a point where our government began to revise its opinion about this progressive liberal and reformer and withdrew its offer. And about the same time, the Soviet government indicated that it was not prepared to finance the dam at all. So that in anger and to save face, and to divert the attention of his people from a great diplomatic defeat which he had suffered, Colonel Nasser seized the Suez Canal, telling his people that from the Suez Canal he would derive the revenues which would help him to build the dam. And as far as the anger of the United States government or people is concerned, he said, they can choke in their fury. This action of Nasser aroused the West, of course. He was not only flaunting international agreements, disturbing a century-old international arrangement, but he was in position now, if he carried out, or if he was allowed to carry out his threat or maintain the position which he had taken, he was in position actually to strangle the economic life of the countries of Europe, if he so chose, if he chose to blockade the canal. The canal is a very important artery of trade for Europe. 40 ships daily pass through that canal. 65 million tons of oil pass through annually through that canal, the lifeblood of the industry of Western Europe. And the Allies now realize that Nasser is quite capable to impose such a blockade whenever he wanted to, whenever he wanted to force a concession from them, because he had done it. He had done it in 1951 when he put a blockade on Israeli shipping in the Suez Canal. They knew about it. They talked about it. They didn't do anything about it, because it wasn't their ox that was gored. Israeli shipping was blockaded. Well, we could meet that situation by passing some kind of a resolution in the Security Council and let it go at that. They did not realize that one step leads to another. That with a dictator, what succeeds once, he will try again, except on a larger scale. Under the convention, of course, of 1888, under which the canal is being operated by the Suez Canal Company, the canal was to be kept open for all shipping of all the nations of the world in time of peace and in time of war. No one had the right to blockade it. And so Great Britain and France and the United States reacted quite violently to this action of Nasser. They would not tolerate, they said, such high-handed methods. Well, here's another Hitler coming to power, they said. Hitler, too, began piecemeal, first the militarization of the Rhineland, and then Sudetenland, you will recall, and the rape of Czechoslovakia, and then came Warsaw, and then came the Second World War. They finally came to realize that this man whom they had been wooing and pampering, they finally came to see him in his true colors. A ruthless, ambitious dictator on the make, who would play off the East against the West, and communism against democracy in the whole world, necessary to satisfy his ambition. And so quickly they summoned an international conference in London, and decisions were arrived at for an international control of the canal. And the Australian Prime Minister Menzies and a committee was dispatched to Cairo to inform Nasser of these proposals, which of course Nasser rejected out of hand, because by now he had an ally, a powerful ally, the Soviet world behind him. And a second conference was called. And the Suez Canal Users Association was brought into being, determined for a showdown. They would send their own ships through the canal with non-Egyptian pilots. They would collect their own tolls. If necessary, they would boycott the Suez Canal altogether, take their ships around the continent of Africa. And the world was waiting for a showdown. But the showdown hasn't come. It's not likely to come. Actually, there is another Munich in the making. Another defeat for the free world. Another triumph for dictatorship and the Soviet world. Because of the disunity of the West and because of their clear and palpable blunders, diplomatic blunders. The blunder, of course, the basic blunder, was to build up this Nasser to a point where he was able to play the game of blackmail. The blunder was to withdraw the British troops from the canal zone without making first sure of the international control of that zone and without insisting upon Nasser to make peace with Israel in the Near East, and to give up his military dreams of conflict. The blunder was that when Nasser acquired that $250 million worth of arms, the West did not reply at once by arming Israel to a point where Nasser's arms would be futile in any attack upon that country. And so to lower the prestige of Nasser and to make him look ridiculous in the Arab world, that was not done. And the disunity among the Western powers is of course clear to anyone. I do not know who is responsible for it, but clearly our own government is not without its share. With an eye perhaps on the coming elections, and in the hope that no action of our government would destroy the great slogan of the peace objectives of the present administration, our State Department let it be known right off the bat that in this issue they will not use any force. Well, if you tell Nasser that you're not going to use any force against him, you're through. Force, my friends, does not necessarily mean war. There are other kinds of force that can be brought to play upon a nation which does not observe international law. The Charter of the League of Nations make provisions for such use of force in the case of threats to peace and breaches of peace. Many steps before the use of military force. There is the complete or partial disruption of economic relations with a guilty country. There is the severance of diplomatic relations. There are blockades. There are all forms of pressures that can be used. And in the case of a small country like Egypt, could be used most effectively. And at first it was indicated by our government that while we are opposed to military force, we are for the use of other pressures. But it wasn't many days before we announced that these other pressures are not to be used either. That we have no intention, for example, to use our surplus cotton in the markets of the world to put a pinch on the economic life of Egypt. We would not even compel, we said, American ship owners whose vessels use foreign nations' flags to comply with the requests of the Suez Canal Users Association. We even granted visas to Americans to go to Egypt to act as pilots for the Egyptian government, while we denied American newspaper men visas to enter China to learn something about the conditions in that country. And so our allies were left high and dry. And as a result, as in all such cases, where the West is unwilling or unable to act, they refer the matter to the United Nations. Where the Soviet veto will effectively block any action which might in any manner embarrass Nasser. This practice of our government to initiate an act and get others to go along and then withdraw from sharing an active responsibility in it is unfortunately not an isolated instance here. We did exactly the same thing in the case of the Baghdad Pact, where we urged the world to create a northern tier of states, Turkey, Iraq, Iran, against the Soviet Union, possible aggression, and then we refused to join it. The situation is grave. Grave because this most recent evidence of Allied disunity may still further lead to a weakening of NATO, of the political and military alliance of the Western world, and it may endanger the position and the economic interests of the free world and the whole of the Middle East. And to the young Republic of Israel, what is taking place poses a real danger. On September the 13th, Prime Minister Eden declared in the House of Commons, "What will be the next step if Colonel Nasser is allowed to succeed in this action, the Suez action? I have no doubt," he said, "what it will be, and I do not think the House has any doubt. Israel." And the danger is great for Israel even if Nasser fails in this Suez affair, because he will then try in his desperation to restore his lost prestige among his people and the whole Arab world by making war on Israel and use that vast armament which he has at his control. The Western world had built up a great golem in Nasser. But in my humble judgment, it is not yet too late to destroy that golem. And it need not be done through war, but through unity among the Western powers and through a new policy with reference to the whole Middle East. And we earnestly hope that the series of defeats which the West has suffered in recent months in connection with the seizure of the canal will have brought home to the political leaders of the Western world a few elementary truths which they should have learned a long time ago. In the Middle East, the West is dealing now not with the legitimate demands of a nascent Arab nationalism, the national ambitions of these Arab countries, Egypt, Syria, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Lebanon, Transjordan. The national ambitions of these Arab countries have been fully realized. They are recognized as independent and sovereign states and are in complete control of their domestic and foreign policy. What the West confronts today in the Near East is not resistance to colonialism. That's a false slogan as applied to these countries at this time. What it faces there is the unbridled ambition of an Egyptian dictator and adventurer who has been augmenting his power and his prestige and is now seeking to establish his hegemony over the whole Arab world. And some Arab governments have come to realize this and to suspect it and to fear it. Nasser is a sprouting dictator whose sympathies are clearly with Moscow and Peking, and whose techniques are exactly those which Hitler used in his rise to power. Nasser, like Hitler, has been helped by the West to reach his present position of bold and arrogant intractability in the fond hope that they would then be able to use him to check the spread of communism. Communism, of course, has not been checked. Nasser has, in fact, proved to be the very key which opened the Middle East to communist infiltration. and he's making possible the realization of the historic Russian expansionist dreams in the Mediterranean. And another elementary truth, which should now be clear to the statesmen of the world, of the free world, is that the problems of the Middle East cannot be solved without reference to the state of Israel, small as that state is. Such attempts to bypass Israel, and by so doing, of course, imperil it, have unfortunately been made time and again. They were made in the case of the Baghdad Pact, a regional security pact from which Israel was deliberately excluded. This was the case in the arming of some of the Arab countries while a virtual arms embargo was imposed upon Israel. And even more recently, in the case of the Suez Canal, international conferences were called and associations were set up to counteract the seizure of the Suez Canal, which pointedly and unreasonably excluded Israel. All the Israeli shipping was blockaded in the Suez Canal. Such attempts to achieve peace and stability in a region of the world in which Israel is an important part, and at the same time to ignore Israel, are doomed to failure. Israel, in my humble judgment, must be regarded as a focal point in any feasible peace strategy in the Middle East. You will never weaken Nasser unless you strengthen Israel. That's as simple as all that. And the Western world can recover the diplomatic initiative which it lost in that part of the world only as it comes to acknowledge this simple fact and proceeds to act accordingly. And this too should be clear to the statesmen of our own country. And I say this without any bitterness at all, because I believe that the leaders of our country are following their best light and the best judgment. But they may be wrong. And events have proved them to be time and again, unfortunately, wrong. In the case of the Middle East, perhaps also in the case of other parts of the world. It should also be clear to the statesmen of our own country that any role of leadership which it wishes to play in this troubled area will not succeed unless our country is prepared to assume their definite and specific commitments. There can be no leadership without obligations. A major foreign policy which does not carry with it definite and calculated involvements is foredoomed to failure. Nor can a country long retain the confidence and trust indispensable to leadership when time and again it advances with its allies and retreats alone. We will not be able to lead the world by proxy. This is true of Suez. This is also true in the case of Israel. Take an example, for example. If our government is persuaded, as I think it is now persuaded, that the vast armaments which the Soviet government has poured into Egypt and other Arab lands in the Near East have seriously endangered the young and democratic state of Israel, which the United States helped to establish and was the first to recognize, and that this dangerous situation calls for urgent rectification, then it should not pass the buck to other governments to correct the imbalance. Such a position possesses the virtue neither of rightness nor a forthrightness. There is another elementary truth which ought to be acknowledged now. The free world cannot, on the one hand, undertake to sell or to give arms to countries in all parts of the world. Our country has granted arms to 36 nations. Nearly $2 billion in military supplies went to nations between January and June of this year from our own government. About two-thirds of these supplies to Europe. I say, the free world cannot, on the one hand, undertake to sell or to give arms to countries in all parts of the world as part of an overall policy to strengthen these countries against possible aggression, realizing that an arms race is actually on, an arms race of vast proportion between the East and the West, and on the other hand, deny the right to the little young Republic of Israel to acquire weapons to defend itself against threatened aggression on the ground that this would encourage an arms race. You cannot blow hot and cold at the same time. And you cannot win battles for democracy with the broken lance of a specious formula. And finally, my good friends, it should also be frankly acknowledged now that the agreements which were negotiated through the commendable efforts of the Secretary of the United Nations for the faithful observance of the truce on the borders of Israel have not yielded the peace and tranquility which it was hoped would result from them. Because these agreements, it should be acknowledged finally, are unrealistic in the extreme. They may be valid for a brief, odd interim period, as part of a brief armistice period. But this period has unfortunately already lasted more than 8 years. And such agreements cannot take the place of a permanent peace settlement. Nations which do not want peace will not long observe a truce. And regrettably, let it be said, let it be acknowledged by the statesmen of the world, neither the United Nations nor the Western powers have ever used their full power and authority during these years to induce the Arab states to negotiate a final peace settlement with Israel, any more than they use their full authority and the sanction called for by the Charter of the United Nations to compel Egypt to lift the blockade against Israeli shipping in the Suez Canal. They rouse themselves to indignation and to action only, and I'm afraid belatedly, when their own toes were stepped upon. It is clear, it should be clear to every right-thinking person that Israel has never been the aggressor against any of its Arab neighbors. Israel doesn't claim an inch of territory from Egypt. Israel does not now hold an inch of territory which belonged to Egypt at any time. Israel has no claims against Egypt. There can be no motives for such aggression on the part of Israel. It was always Israel which was attacked. Therefore, it serves no purpose at all to brand every act of self-defense on the part of the attacked people of Israel as an act of reprisal. Just what exactly is expected of the people of Israel? Is it expected that they should sit there on the borders, on those tents, flaming borders as clay pigeons to be shot at will by Arab terrorists and then to have the families of the slain and the wounded comforted by the fact that a representative of the United Nations has duly rebuked the nation to which the assailant belonged? And is this to continue indefinitely? How long is this situation to continue? Is this all that the United Nations is capable of doing, and all that the Western powers will permit it to do? This desperate and provocative arrangement has nothing to recommend it. And it can be explained only by the fact that the Western powers are angling for other fish in the troubled waters of the Middle East. Clearly, the events of the past few years on the borders of Israel have shown that these acts of premeditated murder are not the result of any isolated Arab soldier having gone berserk, but of Arab governments who have gone berserk. Governments who day by day incite their populations with inflammatory propaganda against Israel, who refuse to negotiate any peace settlement, and who never weary of proclaiming to the world that their unalterable resolve is to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. This is governments gone berserk. To help the Arab governments to regain their political sanity and to check the unbridled ambitions and adventures of Arab dictators of the type of Nasser, who are playing Moscow's game in the Middle East, the state of Israel should not only be helped to arm itself to a point where its preparedness will act as a deterrent to would-be aggressors, but it should be given the security of a binding pact with the free world. And this is far more important than arms, for the cost of military preparedness for a small state like Israel is an economic burden too difficult to bear indefinitely. A new policy, my dear friends, is clearly indicated on the part of the Western world if it hopes to maintain its position in the Middle East. And a policy which cannot be clearly, firmly adopted with any prospect of success unless it takes into consideration deliberately and straightforwardly the legitimate interests of the free and democratic state of Israel, round whom all these military adventures and military alliances are being organized and encouraged. There can be no peace in the Middle East until there is peace between the Arab world and Israel. And that peace is possible if the Western world will begin to think less of oil and more of the rights of free peoples who are struggling to live in freedom, and they would like to live in peace with their neighbors. Much more important than what will come out in reference to the Suez Canal. And they may patch up some kind of a safe-haven device, both for Nasser and for the West. Much more important than that, and if a lasting arrangement is sought, would be a final agreement on the part of the free world to make the position of Israel so secure in the Near East that Arab governments will give up their thoughts of aggression and military adventure. In my humble judgment, this is bound to come. It may not come now. It must come ultimately.